Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, Dr. Martin Luther King's phrase, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice," is often spoken of with a sense of solace in America. We tell ourselves that progress is being made and patience is necessary. Conversations surrounding racial inequity and injustice are perhaps more prevalent now than since the peak of the civil rights movement, but the realities of racial discrimination are still entrenched. People of color are striving to make change and make themselves heard. What can white allies do to help bend the arc further, faster? That's the subject of the talks at this Pachacacha Night Seattle event. What's a Pachacacha? The term has been translated as the sound of conversation. The gathering started in Japan in 2003. The basic format requires speakers to present 20 slides in 20-second intervals. The idea is to keep presentations fast-paced and concise, i.e., not your average boring PowerPoint presentation. This Pachacacha Night Seattle event, Interrupting Whiteness, took place at the Seattle Public Library on June 1st. Please note, this recording contains unedited language of an adult nature. We're presenting our broadcast version here. You'll find the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Artist Roger Fernandez of the Lower Elwha Sklallam Tribe gave the opening presentation.
Khatnington Siam, Khatnington Istrayacha. Thank you, good people, for inviting me to this event. I'm very happy to be here tonight. The topic you're going to be discussing tonight, hear about tonight, consider tonight, is very important. And you are here to try to change something. You're here to try to change the condition that exists now, where racism we imagined was gone, but it's still here. And Native people have always looked at this as a very interesting interpretation of how people are to be measured by the color of their skin. But when I do work with people, I ask them a question. And I will ask you the same question. Complete the following statement. The only good Indian, you can say it, is a dead Indian. And the question becomes, I know none of you believe that, but somewhere deep inside you, that story was planted. I believe it's part of the American psyche. And so the worker here today is not going to be just purely intellectual work, talking about laws and policy and history. It's going to be spiritual work that will allow our spirits to combine with each other, the voices to come together of our spirits. So I'm going to sing to you what's called a changer song. It's a song that acknowledges a being who came to the world and prepared it for human beings. There was a time when there were no humans in the world, but they were to come. They were foretold, and someone came to the world and got the world ready for them. He has many names. One is Duchwabach, one is Stokwal, for whom the Snoqualmie people are named. Another one is Labatea, another one is Khal, many, many names. But he's called the changer by the native people because he changed the world and got the world ready for us. So I'm going to sing you this song because you, by being here, are changers. You want to change the world. So in future generations, that shadow of racism will be disappearing. It will diminish. Our children and great-grandchildren and children after them will look at it as history because they'll find a way to live in the world in a better way because we have created that work. So this is called the changer song, written by my teacher, Bruce Miller. That song was sung to honor the work that you're doing. That song comes from my heart to your heart. That song is meant to begin the conversation, not here, because Western culture prefers to work up here, and I understand that. I was raised in this culture. But the Native people say we must start here. We must start with our heart and speak to each other from our heart, and then our brain, our words will come in to help us do that work. So I don't mean to lecture you in this way that I know better than you. I don't. The struggle that we're in to confront racism has gone on for hundreds of years. But how do we end that? And in my knowledge, experience, what I was taught is that the people who created it must deal with it. The people of color, we've suffered under it, and we have a vested interest in seeing it end. But the people who must do the work are the ones who created it. And I know you did not sit down and create this thing, but the culture you live within, they created it. The idea of race being a measure of people and their worth. And so I'm going to ask that the people of color respect this idea that the white people must address this thing. They must look towards how do we end this thing. One measure I have is who are the great anti-race civil rights leaders among the white people? And usually we can't think of anyone. We might find someone that maybe a few people know, but who is the person that they look to for leadership? What man or woman do they say, this is the one who speaks for us? But again, that's my opinion, and that's why I'm up here. No. I do want to share very quickly a story that the Snoqualmie people tell. I hope this story will give us a crack in the door that we might open that door and have more open conversations, more honest conversations. Storytelling is meant to help us in our heart make sense of things. Because oftentimes when you hear an old story, our brain says, well, that could never happen. These things, a raven cannot turn into a tree leaf. And so, but the stories were not told to speak to us here. They were to speak to us here. So I'm going to tell you a very quick story from the Stoqualmie people, the Snoqualmie people. A long time ago, the world was very different than it is today. Can all of you show me where is the sky? Where is the sky? I knew this was a good audience. Very good. All right. Yes. And how high is the sky? Well, it wasn't always up there. In this story, it was dark and heavy and it was way down here. This is where the sky was, right here. And because of that, the people had to walk around like this all the time. They walked around all bent over because the sky was so low upon them. And they couldn't stand up. They would bump their heads, and so they walked bent over all the time. And because of this, they kept bumping their head. Their backs began to hurt, and they could not see where they were going. They could only see their feet beneath them. And so this dark and heavy sky weighed heavily upon the people. The people decided they needed an answer to this problem of the sky being right here, and they went to an old man in the village. Native people recognize we go to our elders because they're not just smart, they're also wise. They've lived a long time. They know how to solve these big problems. So they went to this elder, and he said, I will think about it. I will think about it. And they came back in a couple days, and he said, we will push up the sky, invite all the tribes here to come to our place, and we will push up the sky together. And so everyone, all the tribes around here were invited to the Snoqualmie village up in the mountains. The plan was explained, how we're going to push up the sky. And everyone agreed it was a good idea. But someone way in the back called out, but there's a big problem here. We all speak different languages here. And it's true, we do. All the tribes here speak different languages. So we all have a different word for push. How can we work together? How can we push together? We all speak different languages. The elder again thought for several days and said, you shall use the word yahout. Yahout will mean work together. Yahout will mean push together. When I say yahout, we all say yahout and push up on that heavy sky. And so I want you all to participate. Called audience participation. It's relatively painless, all right? Put your hands right here. And when I say yahout, I want you all to say yahout and push up on that heavy sky. We're going to push it out of our way. So here we go. Yahout. Yahoo! Yahoo! Is that high enough? No, it's not. Let's get some big long poles and keep pushing it up with those poles using the same words. Here we go. Yahoo! 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 We did it. We pushed the sky up to where it is today. The Snoqualmie people say, if we work together, we can do great things. We can even push up the sky. I tell that story oftentimes when people ask me, how can we get to work together? I'm going to do something as a storyteller I'm not supposed to do, which is give you some interpretations of some of the teachings within the story. Native people call these stories the teachings. And so within this story are teachings of philosophy, of values, of morals, of beliefs. Within them are very, very deeply planted in the story. If you know the story in your heart, then you will understand some of these things. Someone in one of the story groups, telling in a group like this, someone raised their hand and said, that word Yahweh was crucial in his estimation. That we were all different people, different ages, different generations, different genders, different class, different everything. We must find one thing that unites us. That this is the one thing we recognize we will all work towards. Because everything else might be different, but we agree to accomplish this task, the impossible, we must agree on one principle that we all will carry with us. And no matter what our differences, we always come back to that one thing. It will allow us to work together. Because saying we will work together is relatively easy. To actually work together is hard work. So again, I want to say that as Native people, we look at this and say, how can we help in this endeavor? We tell our stories. We try to remind you of our connection to the earth, your connection to the earth. We try to remind you of all these things. And in sharing this story, I'm hoping I give you a sense of that idea of a word that doesn't seem to carry much weight anymore in this culture. It's called wisdom. Wisdom. And that might be part of this conversation. What is the wisdom that we need to bring to this effort to deal with racism as it continues to exist in America today? So again, I sang that song for you in the beginning. That song was a prayer as much as a way of honoring you. We are on the land of the Duch'apsh people, the Duwamish people. And you know their history. You know that before and after the treaties, they were forcibly moved from Seattle by gunpoint. Their villages were burned. They were sent to places like Muckleshoot, where many of them are now, Tulalip, Suquamish Reservation. But their spirit is still here in this land. Si'at, who we call Seattle, for whom the city is named after, he prophesied our people would never leave. We would always be here. So because we're still here, we want to be a voice in all of this work that's being done. So this gesture among our people, this gesture, you see our people doing this all the time, means thank you. It means hello, you're welcome, goodbye. We do it all the time. We call it putting up our hands to people. I put up my hands to you all here today. You could be doing something else, something important in your life, but you've determined that this work is so important, you must be here tonight. You're sacrificing your time to be here. You're sacrificing You're sacrificing to be here tonight. I understand that so many ways. So I put my hands up to you all and say, Chatnitsin Siam, if there's a way I can help you with this work, I will be here. Chatnitsin, thank you. Thank you very much.
Our next speaker is Jed Muir, a lecturer in American and Ethnic Studies and Cultural Studies at the University of Washington, Bothell. Jed teaches, writes, and partners with students, artists, scholars, and organizers to engage race and racism, intersectionality, cultural movements, and social change. His current project focuses on Black radical art and politics in the Pacific Northwest. Please welcome Jed Muir.
Hello. Okay, this is Seven Frames. When Davida, by way of Aretha, asks you to participate, you tell her that two of the things that make you most uncomfortable are white people applauding themselves for anti-racist work and any time a white person speaks at a Q&A. You Google interrupting whiteness, and two of the first four results are racist screeds against public school teachers getting together to address the way that white supremacist ideology shapes educational environments and policies, an act which these commentators deem shockingly racist. Two, whiteness begins through a consensual and solidarist sense of a besieged people, establishing its identity through its own generalization and oppression of those it sees as a threat. Or, as Black Studies scholar and poet Fred Moten puts it, settlers always think they're defending themselves. That's why they build forts on other people's land. And then they freak out over the fact that they're surrounded. In this sense, there is no such thing as a neutral white identity, since whiteness is weaponized against perceived threats, internal and external, a fact which goes some way toward explaining the marriage of whiteness, nationalism, property, and propriety throughout the history of the settler colony of the United States. Three, it is an ironic effect of so much collective insurgency against white supremacy, heteropatriarchy, colonialism, and what the great Cedric Robinson called racial capitalism, that for so many white people, anti-racism means confessing one's privilege. Though such insurgencies, from Marinage to Black Lives Matter, have never been about individual subjects or an individualist notion of liberation, as so many feminists of color have pointed out, white people in schools, activist spaces, nonprofits, etc., tend to perform or deny our privilege as individuals. This points to a deeper problem. Privilege discourse often assumes that white people have something that other people should want. Bell Hooks's mom understood this problem when she told her daughter she could take what white people have to offer, but she didn't have to love them. And Hooks knew that what her mother meant was she shouldn't adopt their ways and institutions and practices at the expense of the ways of knowing and being Hooks carried with her, the rich, radical forms of knowledge and collective social life produced at the margins. 4. Less than a week before the event, you get in a car accident. The damage is bad, the airbag hurts, but you're fine. The white police officer, AKA the police officer, on scene asks you no questions. And not supposed to let you drive home with a deployed airbag, he hands you his 4-inch knife to cut it off yourself. Don't cut me with my own knife, he jokes. 5. The individuating violence of whiteness, including the commitment to the idea that you can own yourself and therefore grasp and know and own the world, might be thought of as an imposition against seeing other ways of being in the world, ways of being most often embodied and lived by whiteness's hated others, the poor, the black, the immigrant, the indigenous, the unsettled. To the extent to which we invest in a vast web of social relations and imaginaries that produce life chances for some and premature death for others, we fail to engage in the collective work Adrian Rich referred to as recognizing whiteness as a point of location for which we must take responsibility. This is what one scholar has called the possessive investment in whiteness. Toni Morrison, one of the keenest theorists of this possessive investment, captures in one paragraph how it destroys possibilities for solidarity, sociality, and collective being, when she describes how Irish immigrants attempt to enter whiteness by participating in gendered anti-black racism. 6. In Citizen, an American Lyric, Claudia Rankine chooses to remove the person who was lynched from a lynching photograph she secured from state archives. Rather than continuing to spectacularize black pain and death, she directs us to the people who believe themselves to be white in the foreground of the image, people who circulate their acts across a vast white network through newspapers, letters, postcards, holiday greetings, and even audio recordings featured publicly in sites like Seattle's Pike Place Market. While your students recognize that Citizen is about microaggressions, anti-black violence, and liberal racism, they also point to all the other things that happen amidst and underneath this violence. Like the moment on the subway when a white man runs over a little boy of color and doesn't see him, has never seen him, and doesn't stop to attempt reparation. The mother of the boy says, "The beautiful thing is that a group of men began to stand behind me like newly found uncles and brothers." 7. In this period of racial capitalism, your job involves spending most days figuring out how to get together and move and think with students who are told, directly and indirectly, that they must reproduce the university by producing themselves as certain kinds of people with certain kinds of stories. Stories that might get them labeled excellent and employable and get their pictures on the diversity website or on the side of a city bus. But they keep fucking up, flipping the script, messing with racialized gender norms, finding new stories to tell and not tell, asking too many questions, demanding and refusing, insisting we talk more about words like hegemony and intersectionality and liberation, thinking a little too critically about basketball and Bollywood, embodying something other than the best, docile, flexible subjects of neoliberalism, finding ways to strategize, to live and be together otherwise, as a Sean Crawley might say, to twist their heads up together. The rich, radical, ongoing histories and resources that animate their ground and this one encourage us to twist up our heads together and strategize and militate toward dismantling whiteness and its inseparable relationship to racial capitalism. From small acts of insurgency, like walking so slowly at the back of a Black Lives Matter march for hours, continually causing a bike gang of police officers to fall over, to large collective projects of non-reformist reform, as abolitionists like Ruth Wilson Gilmore and Avery Gordon call it, aimed at remaking the arrangements of power, property, and propriety that produce life chances for some and premature death for everyone else and for the earth. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Ashley Harrison. Ashley has worked at the Seattle Public Library for 8 years before recently joining the City of Seattle Legislative Department, where she provides operational support for the legislative process. She is a lifelong Washingtonian. Let us give a warm welcome to Ashley Harrison. Hi, good evening. I want to say one thing before I start. I'm probably going to speak very quickly. I'm nervous, and there are a lot of you here. It's lovely to see all your faces, and 20 seconds is not a lot, so please bear with me for the speed run. Seattle's majority whiteness is not happenstance. This whiteness was designed violently. This is from a list of 416 racial restrictive housing covenants in King County. Subdivisions and entire neighborhoods wrote restrictions into their deeds specifying that homes could only be sold or rented to white people. And the restrictions weren't outlawed until the 1968 Fair Housing Act. Federally, the Chinese Exclusion Act was in effect from 1882 to 1943, prohibiting immigration by Chinese laborers who had been coming to the West Coast. And in 1942, nearly 13,000 people of Japanese descent were subjected to forced internment and dispossessed of their lands and assets. I'm already a slide behind. White settlers burned down the Duwamish longhouses to push out the original inhabitants of this land, and all of this is central to our current conversations around race, access, and housing. Who was able to gain a foothold, and how did that shape our city today? So this is to frame a starting assumption that race is a social construct, but we all must reckon with the real and significant harm inflicted on the basis of race. So how can white people disrupt white cultural norms when we also share traits like perfectionism, worship of the written word, and allowing a sense of urgency to win out over other considerations? And I want to credit Kenneth Jones and Tim Okun. That list comes from an excerpt of their, an article excerpted from their book. So how do we push back when the structure of our very organizations mirrors white culture? So here's something that doesn't work. Early in my career and new to working in large institutions, I was concerned about a process with disproportional negative access, negative impact on people of color. And I knew the people in charge of that process and went to them individually, thinking they would take this up once I laid out the evidence. But this did not work. The one-on-one approach, the sincerity without political pressure, did nothing to inspire an examination of the issue. Moving a large institution takes more than sincerity and facts. Engaging one-on-one or in small groups is an extremely important tool. Conversation can be transformative. Talk to your friends and relatives about race and normalize these conversations between white people. But when there's a big power differential between you and the person you're appealing to, you need a larger forum. So this is what I'd look for now. Who shares this concern? Who holds relationships with impacted people so we can get feedback and be accountable? Who are the partners and co-signers? And what are the pressure points? If you want to dismantle vertical power, you have to build horizontal power. Public employees are also represented by unions at a much higher rate than the private sector, and I was active in the union here at SPL. Unions can have a positive effect on wages of diverse groups of employees, but have an uneven track record around racial equity in their internal leadership and impact. Seattle's public school teachers demanded changes to a disciplinary structure to improve student racial equity outcomes and cited that when they went out on strike. But many police unions have chosen to support biased, violent officers by contesting discipline rather than support accountability to the communities they serve. Sometimes even problematic structures offer tools for addressing a specific inequity or offer opportunities to be a buffer. So as a union steward, I worked cases on behalf of individuals. And when I represented employees of color, we sometimes decided together that I would go alone into the formal meetings so the employee could spend their time and energy where they wanted, rather than retelling emotionally draining stories to white decision makers who were focused on what's documented and easily quantifiable. But in that same union context, we did not look at racial equity in our leadership or engage specifically with staff of color to represent their interests. If you only serve the people who engage you, you will chronically underserve many communities. When I first heard this prompt, all I could think of were questions, and some I routinely ask myself, others I've struggled to engage with. One I see as vital to revisit on an ongoing basis is, who are your influences, artistically, politically, literarily, and musically? In whatever media you most consume or create, think about what you take in, and then think about whether most of those creators and producers and people depicted are white. A second question there, are you ever not the intended audience? If you don't seek works where you aren't a primary consideration, everything is being softened for you. This doesn't mean that you have access to every space, that's a harmful notion, but you can learn from books, articles, and interviews without asking people of color to take more of their time to educate you. When I think about what holds me back from deeper engagement, one thing stands out. After final presentations in a college class, my professor George remarked that our mostly white cohort struggled with allowing others even a glimpse into our internal worlds. This comment has stuck with me ever since. And I think that this is white fragility of only letting out the parts of ourselves that match up to these unspoken expectations of whiteness. And this is what white people gain by working to dismantle structural racism, because you cannot engage on someone else's behalf. That's disingenuous and ineffective. But by redistributing power and resources, by amplifying voices telling truths outside of and beyond our conventional wisdom, we will have the opportunity to become someone other than the selves prescribed and constrained by whiteness. When it comes to processing whiteness, my instinct is to stew on this until I can present something fully formed. This isn't something I've adopted consciously, but it takes away accountability and knowledge sharing and deprives me of opportunities to fail and do better. It stops me from contributing because the way that I see it, I don't have anything to contribute yet, but you can't be stuck in that state in perpetuity. An earlier slide, because I'm behind, is Athena, Greek goddess of wisdom, bursting fully formed from Zeus's head. And I just wanted to say, most things don't burst fully formed from your head, especially not wisdom. So I think that this instinct comes from a weird sense that the work is somehow always out of reach. This notion that it's always an external, amorphous thing that I can't quite get to, instead of just seeking better practices for being in the world in more open and less harmful ways. So white people have to talk to other folks about racism so it becomes an embedded practice for us to consider questions of equity, representation, and access throughout our lives. This is a conversation that relies on some shared vocabulary. It may seem strange to seek out other white people as anti-racist resources, but whose job is it to interrupt whiteness? It's ours. I'm aware of two local groups of white people organizing each other and taking leadership from people of color. One is the Coalition of Anti-Racist Whites, and the second is European Descent. And these groups embed accountability into their structure, so it's not just white people talking to each other about social justice to distance ourselves from, quote, those other white people. I think coming into anti-racist work, white people misunderstand what's expected of us and make it out to be bigger, but we don't have the solutions. If you mystify the work as something other than daily practice, it will remain difficult to engage with, so find something concrete and practical to do. It doesn't have to be glamorous. It's probably better if it's behind the scenes helping to amplify voices or shine a light. So what's expected? Learn history. Show up, take leadership from people of color, and be prepared to risk your comfort, your reputation, and your physical safety. We're seeing an outright legislative and often physical assault on communities of color, immigrants, and poor folks. So always amplify the voices of people most affected by an issue. Elect and campaign for people of color and cede space and airtime instead of taking it. Jump in now if you're not doing this already. It's here, it's now, and we need to work together to transform this moment into one of solidarity and hope. Thank you.
The next person up is one of the most luminous voices for racial justice in the city of Seattle and also nationally. Aren't we so proud that one of the most powerful voices for racial justice is a Seattle homegirl? Can you please give a warm round of welcome to Ijeoma Oluwo?
Hi, I am Ijeoma Oluwo, and I am a mixed race black woman who was raised by a white mother in this very white city. I have a PhD in whiteness. And, you know, I was raised in the Seattle Nice. I was kind of, you know, steeped in the good intentions of this city. And I hate it. I love this city. I love you guys. Also, I hate it. I really do. And I'm going to talk a little bit why. I write about race, and I'm regularly reached out to by really well-meaning white people who want to explain to me what my work is like to them as a white person and what, you know, the white perspective that I'm missing. And the only part of the white perspective I'm missing is the ability to be unaware of the white perspective. And that may sound a little arrogant, but if you're a person of color who grew up especially in an area like this, you understand that every decision you make, you're going, what will white people think about this? You have to. You find out around kindergarten, usually, that you've misjudged something and there were disastrous consequences. Maybe it's a friend's house you're no longer allowed to go to, or a letter home from your teacher. But you know really quickly that if you don't know what white people want, what they're doing and why, what's going to make them mad, what's going to make them scared, what's going to make them happy, you will not be able to go anywhere. Not only are you hyper aware of your blackness or your identity of color because there's a spotlight on you 24/7, especially in a city like this where there's five of you, you have to be hyper aware of whiteness as well. And what I've noticed is that nothing really threatens the Seattle identity of liberal utopia than asking white people to acknowledge what whiteness is and where it is in their lives. People tell me to stop making things about race all of the time. When you are not making things about race, you're making them about whiteness. All of the time. Every decision that you make with ease is made with whiteness. Every door that opens for you is opened by whiteness. And I know this sounds like I am taking away all of your achievements, and I'm not. But I need you to understand that from the Constitution, to our education system, to our pop culture, everything that we do is steeped in whiteness. And when you do not acknowledge that, you make it about race. Because then I have to navigate what you won't see. I am tripping over the roadblocks that you don't even know that you're placing in front of me. I am drowning in whiteness. And you can't help me if you can't see it. Now, it's uncomfortable. It is uncomfortable to realize how much easier you may have had things. It is uncomfortable to realize that a lot of the benefits that you may have came at the expense of other people. That makes you feel bad. It makes you feel guilty. And I do not have a solution for that, because it should make you feel bad and it should make you feel guilty. That is not my goal. I mean, sometimes it makes me smile. But I have bigger things to worry about. But I will say this, it will not kill you. But if you don't see it, it will kill me, or it will kill my brother, or it will kill my sons. You have to get used to this. We are drowning in it, and the least you can do is be uncomfortable. Be uncomfortable a lot. And if you are comfortable, take that as a sign that you need to make things more uncomfortable. Do not wait until you are ready to sit down and address race, because I do not get to decide when to address race. I don't get to say, I feel safe, I feel comfortable, I'm going to look at racism now, because racism hits me in the doctor's office. It hits me when I'm driving down the street. It hits me when I'm taking my kids to a movie. Get used to being uncomfortable. Be the person that nobody wants to invite to dinner parties. You are going to get pushback. And I think what we have seen a lot of pushback, right, to the change in national discussion around race. And a lot of what I hear from people is, see, this is what happens. You push too hard. You're going with these identity politics. Of course there's going to be pushback. To investigate whiteness as a threat to identity, to comfort, to privilege, to status. But what is the alternative? Is the alternative then to back off? People are dying. You just keep pushing. You keep going. People push back when they are threatened. And I would love to say that this is not a threat. I would love to say that it is a win-win to address whiteness, but it's not. Some of what you have, you don't deserve. But when you can see your identity clearly, as it is, the good and the bad, when you can see where your whiteness is more than just heritage, more than just culture, but also a system of oppression, you then have the power to do the work to redefine it to something that you can be proud of. But you can't fake it. You cannot just pick up the positive and say that that's all that there is. This will be uncomfortable and it will be painful. But if you continue to do the work, you will have a sense of authenticity in yourself that you have never known. You will stop having to steal all of our stuff. You will have your own stuff. And that's really what I need you to do. I don't need someone standing right next to me doing what I'm doing. If black people could end racism, we would have ended racism. We have died trying to end systemic racism. I need you to do the work in your communities. And it starts with looking at the day-to-day things. What will kill me may not be a cop. It will be my lack of access to quality medical care. It will be my lack of access to quality education. It will be the loans that I am denied. It will be all of the thousands of cuts that people of color endure every single day in white supremacist society. And that is where your life intersects with it. Every time you go through something and it's easy for you, you look around and you say, who is it not easy for? And what can I do to dismantle that system? But in order to do that, you have to be willing to look at it and see it as a part of the system of whiteness, because that's what it is. And then, eventually, you will not be so tense. You will not be so defensive. Because you will know that even if you aren't there, you are actually doing concrete things to make whiteness something that helps instead of hurts. And I know you can do that. I've seen what white people can do when they put their minds to things. I love you, Seattle. And I hope that we can start looking at kindness, which is honest, and built with love over niceness, which prioritizes comfort over safety. We can do this, but first you have to start with yourselves. And then you'll find your place every single day that you can make a measurable impact on not only the lives of people of color, but your own life as well. Thank you.
John Greenberg is an award-winning Seattle Public High School teacher and a contributing writer for Everyday Feminism. Please give a warm round of applause for John Greenberg.
Well, thank you so much. I am honored to be here. Telling me I'm obsessed with talking about racism is like telling me I'm obsessed with swimming when I'm drowning. I am honored to be here, but more than honored, or maybe as much as honored, I'm also very, very conflicted about being here tonight. I hope that every white person in this room is similarly conflicted. Let me start with a question. When you think of prominent educators on white privilege and institutional racism, whose names and faces come to mind? If they belong to white people, then that's reason number one to be conflicted. Very few of the ideas on those topics actually come from white people. Most often, we are just regurgitating what we've learned from folks of color. And so if you learn the names of the white presenters tonight, but not some of those names, we're all complicit in perpetuating, not interrupting, whiteness. Reason number two to be conflicted, our words are not to be trusted alone. They should be taken not with grains of salt, but truckloads of salt. How can you ever really know if a white person is interrupting whiteness if white people are your sole source of intel? Let me put it another way. If you want to know how well the police force is serving the community, don't ask a police officer. Ask the people they serve, especially the brown and black communities. Ask that Ferguson resident. And the same is true for teachers. If you want to know how well I, as a white teacher, interrupt whiteness, don't ask me. Ask my students, especially my students of color. And yes, they look happy in that photo, but I could have been postponing a homework assignment, not interrupting whiteness in that moment. Yet despite all these conflicts about being here, I'm grateful that public education is represented tonight. Let me read you an excerpt from a local story. Quote, about 20 years ago, Seattle Public Schools assigned a committee to look at why black students were more likely than others to be suspended or expelled. But nearly two decades later, little has changed, end quote. This article is from 2001, the same year I began my career with Seattle Public Schools, referencing documented disparities that are now 36 years old, and the disparities have gotten worse. In 2013, the Seattle Times reported that a black middle schooler is nearly four times as likely to be suspended as a white student, a disparity so severe that it attracted a federal investigation by the Department of Education. Black students are so poorly served that on average they test 3.5 grade levels behind white students. The disparity is nearly as great for Latinx students. The dropout rate, what we might want to call the pushout rate for Native students, is over double that of the district average. Folks, we are in a state of emergency, and public education, for the most part, has been let off the hook. We, as educators, are part of systems that replicate egregious racial disparities, and so why aren't we treating the status quo like a state of emergency? Arguably, the answer is the topic that brings us here tonight, whiteness. And when I say whiteness, I could be meaning the color of the advanced classes or the color of fundraising in segregated schools across Seattle. I could be talking about the color of educators. I could be talking about the color of the curriculum, and all those contributors are matter. But tonight, I want to shine a spotlight on curriculum. Perhaps you've heard the proverb, until the lions have their own historians, the history of the hunt will always glorify the hunter. Conventional history is undeniably biased in favor of white Americans, the one group that has consistently benefited from centuries of discrimination. That's why slavery is too often sanitized in textbooks and classrooms. That's why we too often call the invasion of indigenous lands manifest destiny or westward expansion. That's why we too often call the incarceration of 120,000 people of Japanese descent internment. Let's face it, we teachers teach who we are and we teach what we know, and over 80% of us are white. Consequently, in a profession over 80% white, white teachers invariably teach curricula thoroughly bleached and warped by whiteness. So how do we interrupt the prevalence of whiteness in public education? Again, take what I say with a truckload of salt, please. I'm going to attend this event June 15 and hear from my colleagues of color. At the time I wrote this script, there were far fewer Seattleites committed to this event than they were for this one. But since you are here and not there, let me offer one solution: ethnic studies, which emerged out of the civil rights movement and are currently experiencing a resurgence. According to Seattle teacher Tracy Gill, ethnic studies is reversing the idea of white as the default race. Ethnic studies literally interrupt whiteness by decentering white as a dominant perspective. I learned the hard way that in our current setup, you are on your own when you decenter whiteness in the classroom. In 2012, one white family objected to the study of race I was teaching, arguing that lessons on racism were intimidating to white students. Seattle Public Schools was caught unprepared and transferred me, effectively killing the curriculum, at least temporarily. I did win my job back. Ethnic studies, however, institutionalize such curricula, which is why I'm backing the NAACP's push to institute ethnic studies throughout Seattle schools, led by Rita Green. I'm urging you to do the same. Here's an image from our launch on Martin Luther King Day. All the research supports ethnic studies as a solution to these urgent racial disparities. In January 2016, Stanford published the results of a long-term study that showed ethnic studies increasing attendance, GPA, credits earned for our most marginalized students. Unfortunately, it's not folks of color who need convincing. It's white Americans, which is why I'm here tonight, and which is why I wrote that piece, arguing that it's in white people's own best interest to learn ethnic studies. We're the ones who disproportionately get racism wrong. We're the ones who disproportionately remain disengaged. The reality is that my whiteness protects me from negative race-based experiences that folks of color experience all the time. So here's what I've learned. I have to actively put myself into the line of fire, and you'll know you're doing it because you'll start to get some pushback. It could come in the form of white supremacist trolls or administrative transfers. But that pushback is how I get negative race-based experiences as a white person. And if I'm not getting that negative race-based experience, am I really interrupting whiteness? Here's what you could do. You could attend this event. Tell the Seattle School Board to mandate ethnic studies. They are taking too long. White people have had their turn as the curricular protagonist. They've had their turn for centuries. It's time for somebody else to take a turn. That's a lesson so basic that little children learn it at a playground playset. Before I say goodbye, I'd like to say thank you to my family for supporting this work. I hope to see you all at the school board meeting on June 21st. Thank you so much for your time.
Dr. Robin DiAngelo writes on white racial identity and white supremacy. Her work on white fragility has influenced the national dialogue on race. Let us welcome Dr. Robin DiAngelo.
All right, can you hear me? All right, I'm ready. So thank you to Darlene Flynn and Deborah Terry Hayes across many years and many struggles. Mills, Bonilla Silva, Audre Lorde, and Stacey Lee have also been very foundational for me. I stand on the ancestral territories of indigenous peoples, and in a continual loop of colonialist relations, I have benefited from the land and work of peoples of color. Racism is a white problem, yet white people are deeply invested in racism. I am deeply invested in racism. These investments are tenacious and wily and require vigilance, humility, and courage to resist. How did I come to be invested? Well, even before I opened my eyes, the forces of white supremacy were shaping my life. What nutrition, transportation, and environmental safety my mother carried me in,
how my mother was treated in the hospital, who owned that hospital, and who came in that night and mopped the floors. I grew up in the shame of poverty and the silencing of sexism, but I always knew that I was white. I still held the key signifier of ideal beauty and humanity. Whiteness has enabled me to navigate classism and sexism, and I am very clear that white women don't land any more lightly on people of color. My internalized sexism and class inferiority don't make me less racist. In fact, they work powerfully to have me collude with racism through my silence. And my silence on racism enables me to get ahead as a woman and to realign with the dominant white culture my class background separated me from. I have been given the message that I am superior, the human norm, the ideal for humanity. This is not an isolated or singular message. It is relentless, and I and any other white person could not and did not miss that message, regardless of our other intersecting positions. It is a brilliant strategy of racism to teach us that racism can only consist of intentional acts of conscious hatred and meanness, and because we are not mean and unaware of hatred, we believe we are free of racism, untouched by this relentless conditioning. And yes, those were five different girls. And people of color may rightly ask, how is that possible? How could you not know? Why do you lie? Well, we've been taught to be oblivious, but to shut our eyes to what we know. But it is a willful, aggressive refusal to know. We don't want to know or to see. And we work hard at this refusal because to see would fundamentally challenge our identities as good people. It would require us to give up our narratives of racial innocence, of not knowing what we're supposed to do. We claim racial innocence to hide our apathy about racism and our investment in white supremacy. But we cannot admit to this, as we could not align our identities as good people with this knowing. And this makes us very, very irrational racially. Our irrationality functions powerfully as a form of everyday white racial control. I might not be the 1%, but I can make it so miserable for you to talk to me about my racism that you just don't. White fragility is not weak. It is a form of bullying to keep people of color in their place. My current degree of consciousness came when I took a job as a diversity trainer and embarked on a parallel process. One, sustained challenges to my worldview from a significant number of people of color, and I could be a full educated adult and never have had that experience. And two, trying to talk to white people every single day about racism, and the predictable and superficial narratives will surface. Wouldn't you love to do something 60 years ago and be certified as racism-free for the rest of your life? Okay, that would be marching in the 60s. Focus underneath and you can see the pillars of white supremacy that prop these narratives up and how they function to protect whiteness, take race off the table, and render white people exempt from further involvement. Yet working to educate other white people necessarily centers whiteness. As my voice is heard more openly, yet again, it's all about us. My work with other white people is always at the expense of centering myself and decentering peoples of color. So how have I reconciled this dilemma in my work? Well, I can't say I've reconciled it, but I think about it as whiteness is centered in part by remaining unnamed, and I hope to decenter whiteness by laying it bare, exposing, admitting, making visible. No, whites do not represent humanity. We are having a very different experience from people of color. And this leads me to three guiding principles. One, break white solidarity, and yet the pull is so powerful that I will actually privilege my white comfort over black lives. So I remind myself that that niceness does not interrupt racism. Niceness is not courageous. Two, accountability. The number one question I ask myself here is, how do I know? How do I know how well I am doing? How clearly I am thinking? Who I am in relationship with? What do we talk about? Am I ever called in? If not, why not? That's on me. And three, repair. I may do less harm now, but I still do harm. And it's on me to repair with humility, humility, humility. It is not my place to anoint myself an ally. Allyship is a continual process that I must demonstrate in each moment and is ultimately determined by peoples of color. I don't actually know how to interrupt whiteness or how not to perpetrate racism. It is a lifelong struggle. So the essential question that I must keep asking is, how am I doing right now and how do I know? Thank you.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. This Pachacacha Night Seattle event, Interrupting Whiteness, took place at the Seattle Public Library on June 1st. Tune in again soon.